brought to you by SOCOM Acting. Cindy.
1 minute! I just quit firing you! Now listen, we're gonna do this again!
Get off your knees!
Right!
Move out! You quit?
Brought to you by SOCOM Athlete. Cindy.
For nearly six decades, it has been a symbol of one of the most elite fighting groups in the world. A symbol of excellence. A badge of courage. A mark of distinction in the fight for freedom. The soldiers who fill the force are known around the world as quiet professionals, who live up to the words inscribed on the crest of their berets. De oppresso liber, to free the oppressed.
Thanks for tuning in to SOCOM Athletes Podcast. Send me. This is your host, Jason Sweet. I'm here tonight with my brother, Charlie Stetson. He is a Green Beret from 20th Special Forces Group, and he's a huge part of SOCOM Athlete, is a mentor and my good friend. Charlie, thanks for coming on with us tonight, my man. How are you?
Thanks for having me. I'm good.
Good, man. Where are you talking to us from? Up in VA Beach, right?
Yep, I'm up in Virginia Beach right now. Working out of our Armory up in Roanoke Rapids, and you know, doing some remote work from home.
So typically I start these podcasts with an interview of kind of a chronological order of when you were a kid and when you joined the military, why you joined the military, what you were doing and all that. But on this episode, I'd like to start it off by asking you, because we as instructors all seem to ask the students, what is your why? Why do you want to be an operator? Why do you want to do this specific career field? So Charlie, just to start this thing off with a bang, why did you want to be a Green Beret?
Yeah, I think that's like the most important question. And you know, when we did our Hell Day, that was like a huge question I was asking, because I mean, at the end of the day, there's a million jobs in special operations, and you know, whatever you want to do, there's something for you. But too often I see, you know, everybody like picking the wrong, like I'm so sick of the answer of, well, because I want to be part of a brotherhood. Well, I mean, you know, carpenters have a brotherhood. You know, we it doesn't mean anything. So, I joined the Army, you know, and I'd be lying if I said anything else. I joined the Army because I didn't want to stop playing locker room sports. I didn't, you know, I got in trouble in high school. I wasn't going to go to any college, and I wasn't ready to go to college. So I wanted to, you know, the war was really raging. And so I was like, well, you know, I figured that's going to be like the equivalent of playing a locker room sport. And I wasn't completely wrong, but I didn't decide to be a Green Beret until, you know, 2010, I guess I began that process, and I joined in 05.
So you actually joined the Army before that. And you ended up being like a heavy machine gunner up in Alaska or something like that, Charlie?
So, yeah. So I went to,
Did you know about being a Green Beret before you joined the Army, or were you like too young, or?
Honestly, I didn't know anything about it. And when I joined the Army, you know, I listened to my drill sergeants because I thought they were like the be all end all, because that's how they're presented, and rightfully so. But I think I listened way too hard to the, you'll never make it, you guys will never make it. When looking back, it's like, well, that's because you never made it. And it was like really sort of specific individuals that were very negative. Again, another reason why this program is so important is because we take that mystique away, and we show kids that this is super possible, and it's well within everybody's reach. I just didn't know about it.
So you didn't even know about it, and you were like, I'm going to join the Army because I still want to be a part of somewhat type of a brotherhood. I want to be a part of a team. I want to compete towards a mission, a common goal. And that's what ultimately attracted you to the military, somewhat of a sense of purpose.
Yeah, it was a camaraderie. I didn't want to lose a locker room camaraderie. And I knew that I hadn't set myself up to do anything in academia. And so the Army was like this perfect option for me where, but you know, and I went into it thinking it was going to be a lot easier than it was. I'd never really worked hard for anything in my life to that point. So I joined the infantry and got, you know, a swift kick in the ass. And that was, I'd never worked hard for anything. And I had a lot of friends in high school, and that was what was important. And I thought in the Army, I could do the same thing, particularly because basic training wasn't really a challenge. It was fun. And so I rolled right into my first unit up in Alaska, just having fun, not really putting any time into it. And I very quickly was at the bottom of the barrel. You know, I was that guy. I was getting in trouble. I wasn't doing well on really anything that was outside of the field. And so that was
how sort old of the, were you, Charlie? Were you 19?
I was 18.
18. So Charlie, tell us a little bit about this Alaska unit, man. I heard it's a pretty cool unit, infantry unit up there. What was that all about? And what was it like to go up to Alaska?
It was amazing. Honestly, most of the people that didn't PCS or ETS when they were there, those guys are still up there. It was 4th Brigade, 25th Infantry, so they're airborne brigade, which was great, although
they had to jump out of some planes.
Yeah, which is real nice to land in the snow. Not so great to hump through it on the DZ, but I'll say that there's nothing like standing in formation when it's 10 degrees or 5 degrees in the middle of January and then somebody says tropic lightning. My entire career, those are the guys that I'm still closest with, were the guys up. It was a brand new unit at the time. It stood up in October. I got there in December. We knew we were deploying the next October. It was a brand new unit as it was. The beauty for me was they basically formed this unit by walking around Fort Bragg and saying, hey, who hates Bragg? And everyone that raised their hand got to go to Alaska. So
did everyone raise their hand without knowing where they were going to go or what?
I think it was, hey, we're starting a new unit in Alaska. If you don't like people yelling at you for walking 6 inches from the edge of the sidewalk, how about you go to Alaska? So right off the bat, it was very, very result oriented, as much as a big army unit can be. You know, much less haircuts, much more, let's go out into the woods and shoot some guns. It was an awesome unit, awesome unit. And then we trained and trained and trained basically that first year nonstop. Went over to Iraq that October and spent 15 months over there. And man, like, just what a great trip that was. We were so lucky, you know, probably half a dozen, maybe a dozen IEDs total, like a handful of RPG attacks, and everything else was small arms, and we were dismounted for everything. So it's like, you know,
it was like right in the action the whole time.
It was an infantryman's wet dream. It's not fun when you're dealing with that stuff, but when you're really well trained and you get guys that are sort of popping and running, and it's very easy to shoot and maneuver on them, like, that's so fun. And
that's what we got to do. I know what you're saying. You know, you're an athlete or former athlete, and you're like, okay, I'm trying to get into the Army so I can do this. You trained hard. You jumped out of airplanes. You humped around the snow in Alaska. You shot guns all the time. And then you had to learn how to work as a team and go train to fight the enemy. And you went over there and you fought the enemy. You got to do what you were trained to do. So, I mean, it would be pretty wild to just practice all the time in sports and then never play in a game. Who would want to do that? So,
yeah,
I get exactly what you're saying.
Like, if you're a football player and you're practicing and you're practicing, and then all of a sudden you go up to line up against the other team, and they're like, by the way, the floor is just going to drop out whenever we want to. But I'll tell you one story about that trip that's like, it was like one of the most amazing experiences of my life. Is so we went over there October of 06, and from probably October until April, May time frame, right, we fought what's now known as Jaish al-Mahdi. Back then it was the Mahdi Army, Mahdi Militia. It was much less organized. It wasn't sort of the tour de force that it is today. We fought these guys, and so these guys are a Shia militia group. We're in a city that's Shia dominated, and so all of a sudden there's all this sectarian violence in the city because we're sitting at the north. From the south of the city, Al-Qaeda, AQIZ moves in. They're obviously Sunni, super strict, you know, setting curfews, there's infighting. So one day their sheikhs come to us and they say, hey, we're out there fighting these guys and your helicopters are just shooting everybody with an AK down here. Why don't we sort of enemy of my enemy this thing? Fast forward over a couple weeks, couple months, it's like, okay, now we're fighting right alongside these guys against AQIZ. So the same guys we fought against, and I mean the same guys, now we were not only fighting alongside them, but we, such good friends. We loved them. We had a Republican Guard RPG instructor. We had some real bad dudes, some of their sheikhs, some of their fighters. It was great, man. And the story I always tell people is we had this guy in our unit. His name was Carl. And this dude was, he stood out from the rest of us. One, because he was Jack Diesel. And two, because he was very dark skinned. He was a black guy. He was very dark skinned. So he stood out. we're sitting there one day with all these guys and all the Terps are sort of, you know, bouncing back and forth. We're all joking around and everyone's starting to tell like kind of war stories, except we've only fought. We were all kids. The only war we fought was against the guys we were joking around with right now.
Who exactly were the guys that you're fighting alongside that you're mentioning here?
Shia militia groups. So,
okay. So you're fighting alongside of these Shia militia groups. Tell us a little bit about who these Shias are.
So most of the country was Shia. And again, so there's going to be some political science major out there that's going to correct me on some of this, but I'll tell you from a grunt's point of view, most of the country was Shia. It was run by Baathists. And when we overthrew, there was this overwhelming surge of Shia militias because most of the country fell in line with that. But it was city by city, and so you have your Shias and your Sunnis are really the alpha and the omega there. And they're infighting each other. And, I mean, there were days where we fought when we were fighting the Mahdi militia, we'd roll through a Sunni city and we wouldn't be touched because they knew we were going right down the street to a Shia city. It's very sensitive. It really becomes an enemy of my enemy thing. Like the last time I was in Iraq in 2016 and 17, same guys we fought alongside back in 06, 07 were the same guys that were tensions were rising with them. So one day, the guy fighting next to you one day could be your enemy, the next day your friend, the next day your enemy. Case in point, Jay Shalmati.
So you got this big dude with you. He's standing out.
Yeah. So this, one of the Iraqis is sitting there, one of the Shia militia group guys. He's talking about how he used to be a sniper, and all of his friends are sort of making fun of him, and they're like, "Oh man, you just had a 22. Well, Carl had a bullet in his shoulder, had a bullet wound in his shoulder from a 22, which Carl was the size of a Mack truck. So it essentially was like, you
this
know,
dude cutting, shot Carl?
This dude shot Carl. So Carl stands up, and he's like, "Do you know who I am?" Of course the guy knew who he was. He was the only one that looked like that. And the guy was kind of sheepish at first. And I just talked to Carl about this story, I think, 2 days ago, too. And the guy thinks Carl is just about to pound him into oblivion because Carl pulls over his collar, and he's got a big piece of scar tissue right there from getting shot with a little chipmunk gun. And Carl just starts laughing. The guy said something like, I pew-pew you. And, like, they literally, like, high-fived. And then we just kept on going with the day. So here we are, literally sitting in a room with these guys, bullshitting about war stories against each other.
And Carl let this guy live, huh?
We loved these. We really did. We loved these guys. And without knowing it at the time, that was my first step towards really wanting to be a Green Beret, because our mission is not to go kick doors in and shoot people in the face. That's a very, very small part of what we do. It's all about cultural assimilation. So learning that these guys who, you know, as a big army infantryman, you're just like, kill them all, you know, blood, blood, blood. And then all of a sudden you're like, actually, that dude's pretty cool, man. I like him a lot. So once you learn that, like, at the ground, basically everybody's the same guy. For every guy we had telling fart jokes on our side, we had another guy doing the same thing on their side. And so that's one of the things I love about being a Green Beret is they'll throw you into a place and sometimes you're not really sure if you're supposed to be making friends with this guy, but you're just kind of like, you know what? Screw it.
But you guys had a mutual respect as warriors. Mm-hmm. And that's, you guys were able to form a bond on that. But of course you're fighting against the same enemy. And I've heard a lot of people talk about how there's nothing like the power of rallying together against something that you hate or something that you are fighting against. Yeah. That's the quickest way to get two sides to join.
Yeah, it was amazing experience. And that fighting alongside these guys that we fought against for so many months was a huge piece of why I think the things that I am good at being a Green Beret, they're why I'm so good at it. Going native, culturally assimilating, you know, becoming that cultural chameleon where you blend in, getting guys that don't know you, that have no, your backgrounds couldn't be more different. And all of a sudden, you know, a week into living with them, it's like they'll follow you to hell. It's all because when I was 18, I realized, like, you know what? These guys are literally just us. Like, this guy's not a shot caller, and neither am I. Like, we're the same dude. We just happen to be on different sides.
You mentioned in high school you had a lot of friends. So this was something that you enjoyed, meeting new people and learning about cultures, right? So, I mean, being a Green Beret was right down your alley. And we asked you in the beginning of the podcast, what was your why? And it's not a simple why. It looks like to me that it was a developing why. So you had to really get in there and join the Army first and then learn about what being a Green Beret is all about. So that's pretty cool, Charlie.
I honestly, my why is it's like, well, I love learning other languages. I don't think for me, there's no such thing as culture shock because I'm never shocked by it. I love every second of it. I embrace it. I like the long con when it comes to dealing with partner forces and stuff. I like being told, like, Africa was a great trip for me, my first trip to Central Africa, because they said, hey, we got 30 Ugandans and we got 10 local militia. They can't work together and we're stretched thin because we're split team. Charlie, go handle it. Good, great. Close the curtain, leave me alone. I'm going to go make best friends with all these guys. And then I'm going to train them up and I'm going to turn these farmers into pipe hitters. And when it's time to go, they're not going to question me because I'm not their boss. I'm their like best friend. So there's no other job that allows me to be myself. And, you know, they say, find what you're good at and make it your profession. Well, this is what I'm good at. I like making friends with people and I love training and teaching and I love doing it in Spanish, obviously not in Africa.
Did you just talk in Spanish the whole time at the Hell Day or what? Like, como se dice, get wet and sandy and bear crawl down to the surf in Espanol?
Muerte y vete para el agua, y mete en toda la arena.
All right, dude, you for sure got to talk in Spanish the entire Hell Day. All right, man. So let's rewind a little bit, Charlie. When you were a kid, did you know about the military and kind of what it offered? Like, obviously people know about the Army, but I mean, were you into it? Like, was it something that was kind of foreign to you, or were like people in your family in the military, were your friends going in the military? Was it something you considered doing, or what was that all about?
No. So my story of joining the Army is not a path to follow. My grandfather was in the Navy. He was a PT boat captain. My other grandfather was in the Navy. He was a minesweeper. No, we did not have a rich military tradition. I got in a lot of trouble in high school. I got kicked out of a couple of them.
What, were you a scrapper or what?
No.
You don't need to talk about it if you don't want to.
But. Well, some alcohol charges, right? And, I got caught smoking weed in one of my dorm rooms, got kicked out of that school. I was just I was a spoiled middle-class kid who never had to work for anything, and so I didn't. And so I joined the Army because I had gotten in trouble. I wasn't going to the school I wanted to go to. So I didn't, I got in trouble, so I didn't even finish applying. And then I had no idea what to do. So I was like, well, I guess I'll move to California. And I just didn't want to go to class. So I was like, I needed a good excuse. So I went to the recruiter's office, walked into the Navy office. The guy would not stop talking about Motley Crue. So I said, all right, no thanks. And then I walked into the Marine office. Now I had like bleached hair down to my shoulders. I was probably wearing two or three hemp necklaces. These two kids that weren't
like a hippie, huh?
Oh yeah, and these two kids
were you skinny at the time or what, Charlie? I mean, you're pretty jacked now.
Same height as I am now, 100 pounds less. I was a skeleton.
So you weighed what, 110 pounds?
120, yeah.
Okay, so you're 6'1", 6'2", 120 pounds, dude. You were a stick. You look like Hank Williams Sr.
Yeah. So I walk into the Marine office. There's these two kids that haven't joined yet, shaved heads, doing push-ups. These two Marines are in their face, like, get it. And I said, nope, not doing that either. I didn't want to work for anything. So I walked into the Army office, and the guy goes, hey, man, it's kind of like skydiving, and you can go wherever you want, and I'll give you 10 Gs. And I was like, yeah, whatever, man. Let's do it. And I just walked in, and I was like, I like playing – hockey and lacrosse, and I don't really want to go to college. And he just played right. He goes, oh, sweet, man, just come hang out with us. Basically a varsity spot. I was like, oh, cool. So I had no ambition and I had no direction. And I thought, well, I'll be I'll be that episode of The Simpsons where Bart goes to military school for 6 months. He comes out just a machine. Obviously that's not how it is, but I did get everything I needed And, you know, with only some of the stuff that I thought I was going to get, I got everything I needed, which was wake the fuck up, because life isn't given to you. You're a rich white kid from New England in a town with two yacht clubs. And when you got expelled from your first high school, your dad sent you to Spain for the summer. Like, that's not how life is. And so
you felt some conviction, Charlie. You were like, man, like, I got to go do something with myself. Like, you felt a calling.
Yeah, I honestly just wanted direction. And I didn't care what that direction was. I didn't care about the war. Obviously, I wasn't ambivalent, but, like, I wasn't bleeding red, white, and blue. I just didn't have any direction, and I thought I'd get some. And I did. It just wasn't the direction I thought. Because when I got in and all of a sudden everyone was looking at me, and I was like, hey, guys, you want to go drink tonight? And they were like, no, we don't like you because you're not good at this because you don't take it seriously. And so I got socially ostracized for those first couple months. And then I was like, you know what? It's time to clean this up. And that was the first step of, if you're going to do something, do it well. You, Charlie, you enlisted for 4 years. So ride it out and do nothing or get good at this. So I got good at it. And, you know, and that's when you start finding out, you know, my dad used to say in high school, I'd be like, this class is boring. He'd be like, that's on you. If you can't find something interesting about what you're doing, it's on you. And so I sort of went to the Army and I was like, this sucks. Nobody likes me. I don't like it. And I was like, you know what? Everyone else likes it. Everyone else is going out drinking on the weekends. Maybe it's on me.
So Charlie, you mentioned that you got in some trouble in high school. You're talking about smoking weed, getting kicked out of school. How were you able to talk to your recruiter, and how was your recruiter able to get you in the Army even though you got into some trouble? Because obviously a lot of guys that end up going into the military and going into special operations, like, they got into a little bit of trouble in school. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so this guy's definitely out of the Army, so I'm not really worried. And I don't even remember his name. Knowing so little, I literally asked him, I was like, am I going to have to cut my hair? He was like, yes. And then my next question was like, well, do I got to stop smoking weed? And he was like, yes. And so he gave me some take-home tests, and he's like, piss in it till it's purple, and then come back to me. It was the George W. days, man. You know, half the guys in my platoon in basic training were go to war, go to jail kids.
But you got clean, and you were good to go. That's what he cared about. No, I think it's great that you're being transparent, because there's a lot of people out there that were in the exact same shoes.
Yeah, that was sort of a time that I didn't appreciate. It was like, hey, clean up, get in shape, let's do this. And really, again, I keep harping on that first year in the Army where I just expected everything to be given to me. And that was the moment where it was like, clean your act up. I was already obviously joined the Army, so I wasn't doing any drugs. And, you know, but it was like, maybe don't go drinking on a Tuesday because you're in the infantry and that's what you're supposed to do. Like, maybe, like, work out. Maybe open a book, you know, read your 7-8. Tomorrow when you walk in and they ask you, like, hey, I need you to describe to me a platoon raid, okay? You're the weasel. What's your primary responsibilities? Well, maybe I should know that. Maybe don't wait for someone to teach me it, like, because until then, I'm not going to be of any value. And that lesson has been taught to me over and over and over. And I'll tell you what my first team sergeant said to me my very first day, on my first day in group. I walked in, and he's like, what do you have to offer us? And I was like, well, and of course, my first words were, well, in the Q course. He was like, stop. Everybody here graduated the Q course. I'm glad you walked around brag with your long tab and your beret and you felt like a big shot. But everybody here, that's the baseline. So don't tell me you're a Green Beret and that's what you have to offer. What do you have to offer? So, language, you know, and really not much else. I had a good language score. So I went down to Colombia. I became a jungle commando. So I came back and I was like, I know more about the jungle than any of you. Then I spent a couple of years in the jungle on different trips.
Okay, hold up real quick, Charlie. Tell us about jungle commando school, because that's pretty cool. And there's not a whole lot of guys that even know about that, much less have gone down there and got that commando tag.
So I'll tell you, first of all, in full disclosure, there's much like our Ranger tab, you know, we have our bat boys and we have our ranger tabbed guys. I am not the equivalent of, I'm not a bat boy. I would be just tabbed. So there is a separate 6-month commando course in Colombia. And there, that if you pass that, that's their special forces course. Then you go to 1st, 2nd, 3rd commando battalions down there. That is like, that's bat boys. In Colombia, if you're Lancero qualified, which I'll talk about in a second, and you're airborne qualified and you're in a special forces unit, you're authorized to wear a commando tab, which is just beyond valuable when you're in, especially Southcom, but really everywhere in the world. Everyone loves to call themselves a commando, but it's super cool to actually be one. So basically what I did, I went through the Q course with a Lancero instructor. With Lancero school is Colombia's version of Ranger school. It's 4 months, 3.5 months. I went through with one of their instructors, and he was like, hey, you should go. I mean, why not go? And then I do my first trip to Paraguay in, June of 2014. And super fun trip, had a blast. Boy, best kept secret on the planet, that place. And I find out while I'm there that I can only go to the international class, which is starting in September. So really not a lot of time to plan. And I ended up getting in because General Kelly was the head of Southern Command at the time, 4-star. He comes down to watch our collects at the end and does the, obligatory, does anybody need anything? And I was a brand new E6. And I was like, well, I do. And everyone, of course, I get the look like, hey, shut up. And so I'm like, I want to go to Lancero school. And he's like, I don't know what that is. So basically he just goes, yeah, I don't care. It's fine. So I used that to call. Basically, I started at a junior Bravo in 7th group and made my way up to the right sergeant major and said, put me on the list. My group said, if you get Lancero school to call us or email us and say, he's on our list, we'll find you the money to go. So everybody that was like, what? No, it's way too late. I said, well, General Kelly said I could go. Oh, all right, I'll work on it. So I end up going down to Colombia like 2 weeks before the class starts to acclimate. Had a blast in Colombia. Probably didn't spend as much time training and acclimating as I should have. So much fun. But I got to know like the instructors, some of the students beforehand, some of the international ones. And then, class starts. Well, that class, it is the greatest experience I'll ever have that I would cut my own hands off before I ever did again. It was an amazing experience, and I learned so much.
But you never do it again.
Oh, my goodness, no. So, again, I'm not a Ranger, never been to Ranger school. Know enough about it to tell you that in Ranger school, you get a lot more food than Lancero school. But in Lancero school, you sleep a lot more after the first 7 weeks than you do in Ranger school. So, Ranger school, you're out in the field, you're very, very hungry, you're starving. And then between, they're like, hey, get some calories because we're going to just rip your soul out again. In Lancero school, from day one, they feed you a little bit, and it's less and less. And, a couple times through the course, they'll give you that big, big feast dinner. But it's very much, you're going to starve in that school. So it's an amazing experience. You start off, you do a week going to the hospital from open to close, blood tests, all that stuff. And then they keep you in standing in formation. They let you sleep 4 hours a night. But it's kind of, you're at the hospital, so you sleep in the chairs and stuff. You're kind of like not realizing how bad it's about to be. Then they start the first 2 weeks called patio phase. And that is where it's like just no sleep. It's very much like I think what the first week of Ranger school is like, where it's all classroom stuff. You're going to do your ranges, your grenade ranges. You're going to do a lot of rucks. You do Taekwondo every night. You do, and just classroom, and really just no sleep. You're hallucinating like the whole time. But it's fun. The Taekwondo thing is great. They're really great at hyping you up and making things fun. It's not particularly hard. It just sucks. So
were you the only American in this course?
There were 8 Americans that started, 7 graduated, and I couldn't tell you how many international students. I want to say probably 20 total out of maybe 80 or 90 students.
So it's a big class.
Yeah, it's a big class split into 2 platoons.
And it obviously wasn't just Colombians and Americans.
Yeah, we had, oh boy, we had like Hondo, Panama. We had Ecuador, Brazil, Mexico, El Sal. We had just a time. I mean, I'm probably leaving a bunch of countries off there. It was a lot.
But Spanish-speaking countries.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I know Canadians have gone through it before, but we didn't have any. So then you finish those 2 weeks, then you go off into what's called cell phase with Centro de Entrenamiento Lancero. And that's like what you would maybe call Darby phase, where it's like receive a mission, plan it, brief it, execute it, receive another mission. So that's what's in this area called La Maraña, which is basically a draw up and down mountains. So your movements are only like 2K, but that's all night, just all night moving. That's where you're going to do a lot of your stuff that you won't, it would take too long to really go into them in depth, but stuff that works in the jungle that doesn't work other places, like deception methods, and specific tactics that you think you know how to do it. You're like, oh, whatever, I'll sleep through this class. And then you wake up and you're like, oh my God, this is not how we run an ambush. This is not how we do a raid. Because it's just the environment is so unforgiving and you don't have the opportunity and the tools don't work. You know, your radio, it's not going to do line of sight or SATCOM or anything. Anyway, then you go do mountain phase, 10 days up in the mountains near Bogota. It's all just so high up that, you know, you're winded the entire time. And then you go do your last month, which is jungle phase down in Leticia, and that's going to be triple canopy. And that is where you make your money because you learn how to do all of the things that you take for granted, like navigating in the jungle. You know, all of the things that you've practiced the whole course, executing it in a real triple canopy environment, which is just night and day from anything else.
So you guys did some SEER stuff there too, little survival stuff.
Yeah. So we did a survival day in the mountains. That was cold. We did a SEER camp in the jungle. That was just without a close second, the worst 4 days of my life. It was violent. It was really brutal. A lot of stuff. I'm not sure what I'm allowed to say, but you know, that's a bad four days. But what I learned is while for the U.S., a lot of our training is based on, I need to make sure you're tough. I need to make sure you won't quit. But I also need you to learn how to do this job. The jungle is so unforgiving that, like, yes, you're going to learn how to do stuff. Yes, you're going to learn your job. But infinitely more important, I need to make sure that 4 days into a 12-day jungle mission, you're not going to just sit down and say, I'm done. Because it's so miserable in the jungle that, like, their training is all based on, I am going to snatch your soul morning, noon, and night because I need to make sure that you're not going to quit. I'm going to make it harder than it will ever be and more miserable, and you're going to be like, there's no point. Why am I just shoving my head in the sand? Well, because when you go out on patrol, you won't have to. And if you can do it now, then you won't quit then.
So this was one of the highlights of your entire career, was going down to this school.
Oh, without a doubt. I would give up my long tab before I ever gave up my Lancero and my commando tabs. They're like absolutely my pride and joy.
So Charlie, where did you end up going after that?
Immediately after that, I got sent to Central Africa for the Joseph Kony mission, which was amazing for me because I got to really cut my teeth on everything I just learned in an equally unforgiving jungle. Central African jungle is not the Amazon, but it is just as miserable. So I got to do some really amazing stuff over there. Definitely my most fun trip I've ever done with SF. And the highlight for me was, here I was talking all this game. Oh, we had this great jungle tracking class. I can track people in the jungle. And then one day they came and they were like, hey, we got a group. They saw him yesterday. We're going to drop you in with three other guys. We're going to drop you in from a bird, and you're going to go track these people, and you're going to tell me. And I went, oh, shit. I just did this in training. I hope that I'm as good as I say I was. And it was amazing because the things you learned in the tracking class in Lancero school, we extracted a bunch of TTPs from them.
You didn't have to starve that whole time. We
ate off the local economy. We also, when we were back at our little camp, we had basically a chow hall We were not wanting there. That was the SF trip. That was, hey, grow your beard. Don't wear your uniform. Like, hang out. Here's all the stuff you wouldn't get in the big army, like really good food, protein shakes. You need money for a gym. Here it is. All right, now go out in the jungle and work with your partner force. Like, that was just the penultimate trip for me.
So, Charlie, tell our listeners some of the differences between your standard loadout, being your kit, how many magazines you're going to have, the type of weaponry you're going to take, what's going to be in your pack for the desert versus in the jungle.
Okay, everybody's seen Black Hawk Down. Nobody's going to let that happen again. You know, nobody's going to be unprepared. You're going to have extra ammo and extra batteries, extra everything you need. Well, the jungle, particularly like triple canopy, or I would even say single canopy is even worse. I never wore plates once into it. I stripped my rifle, didn't have anything on it but a reflex optic. I did have nods. I didn't use them very often because they work on ambient light. And if you got a thick canopy, I mean, you know, you're really just working off an IR light anyway. It's water and ammo and food. That's it. You never sleep on the ground. So everybody has those Eno hammocks are the best, no free ads, but they're the greatest. I had a poncho that I stole from the Colombian army that was just the size of my garage. So I never had to worry about rain or anything. My loadout for the jungle, I don't want to say it was for comfort, but it was like, you'd see guys and their first trip out, they'd be bringing the kitchen sink. And I'd be like, okay, like I'm telling you not to, but I mean, you'll live. And you just see, you just see them suffering really bad because it's dead still air inside the jungle. So you're just going to sweat. I call it the jungle tax, 10% of your body weight, 10% of your equipment. You're going to lose it all in there. So water, food, hammock, ammo. That's what you need.
What was your favorite food to pack out there?
I definitely am. We got those great First Strike meals. So I just would absolutely annihilate those things. Killer. And it was just applesauce all day for me. Just applesauce all day. Sometimes I would bring canned food, but honestly, it was just too much weight. Like, it's all about staying light and nimble because it's all ducking under branches and squeezing through this hole. And like, you can't be the Stay Puft marshmallow squeezing into a Humvee in the jungle.
So, Charlie, let's rewind a little bit. Tell us about selection and what it was like for you as a young dude to cross over from being an infantryman to a Green Beret.
I actually got out of the Army after my first 5 years. And when I tried to join up again, they were going through a massive cut. So I joined the National Guard because I couldn't go active duty. So I went to the National Guard, and I think there was just a lot of hubris. It was, you know, oh, fucking National Guard. Like, yeah, I'm 25th, baby. Ugh. So what we do is we do a program called SFRE where they run you through the major gates of selection before you go to selection. I went to like six, but I did three of them before I got my selection date. First one absolutely broke me in half, humbled me to the core. Second one I passed. But I passed, you know, who cares? Third one, I crushed it. So they gave me a selection date. And then when I went to selection, this was a big why for me. So I was working at an ice rink. I was driving a Zamboni and I was sharpening ice skates. I loved it. And if they paid me $100,000, I would be Hans from the Mighty Ducks. But they weren't. It was $12 an hour. I couldn't be an adult with that job. So my whole thing was, I'm not going back.
So Charlie, tell us a little bit about 20th Special Forces Group, because the Army Green Beret side of the house offers a pretty cool opportunity where you can go to 19th or 20th Special Forces Group, which is a National Guard entity. You choose the unit that you want to try out for, and these units are all over the country. And then they say, all right, we're going to put you through this modified interview process, which is that 3 to 4 day SFRE, the Special Forces Readiness Exercise. And then if you make it through, they pick you up, then they send you on out to Special Forces Assessment and Selection, which you and I were just talking about. Then you go off to the Q course. Tell us a little bit about what that's all about, man. Sounds like an awesome opportunity to be able to be a Green Beret part-time or full-time in the National Guard.
So it can be the best of both worlds. And I would say it is exactly what you put into it, that's what you'll take out. You know, it gives you an opportunity to have a second career. So we have a lot of guys that work for, you know, one of the agencies, or they're cops, or they're firemen, or they're businessmen, or whatever they are. And there's times when, you know, we have FBI agents that are like, I can't deploy right now. I got a case. Can't do it. And then we also have the other side, which is, you know, guard bums like me, where it's just you hop trip to trip, and you essentially get to say yes or no as much or as little as you want to. And we really do. We get the NCO Corps, I think, is really great because you get so much experience coming from different groups. Literally, the guard teams are just loaded with experience. It's not just, you know, guys that are in this sort of weekend parachuting beer drinking club.
Well, you guys also have full-time personnel at those units, the AGRs, Active Guard Reserve, right? So
yeah.
These are the guys. There's obviously not a ton of slots on each team, but these are the full-time Green Berets. And then there's full-time support personnel at the unit so that they can facilitate that training. And then you were talking about being a guard bum or whatever. And for our listeners out there, what that means is, as a Green Beret, you're HALO qualified, or you have to maintain a certain amount of flight hours or shoot X amount of times per quarter, or maybe you're an 18 Delta and you have to keep your medical quals per quarter. That ends up getting you into work quite a bit throughout the month. Or maybe you're in school or you're doing a job like Charlie said, and you schedule or block off 2 months of training, and then you're going to deploy 2 years down the road, but you know exactly when it's going to be there. So it sounds to me, Charlie, that there's a lot of experienced guys that maybe go there for a change of pace. There's a mixture of young guys. There's full-time guys. Would that
Yeah, you really get a full spectrum. And obviously, you're not going to get all the things that an active duty group is going to offer. But the trade-off to maybe not having a CRIF company, which, you know, nobody has now, but the trade-off to losing something like that is, well, you know, one of my last team leaders, he works for the agency, so he has, you know, all kinds of resources and knowledge that he brings to the table. And I'm not going to go ahead and say, like, everyone's a pilot, everyone's a doctor, so they bring, you know, that thing to the table. But I will say, like, you know, for instance, I taught a SEER course for 3 years on the civilian side, so that's great to bring to the table. There is a lot of experience and stuff. You're going to get the full spectrum, and there's just endless opportunity if you want for schools, whatever you want to do.
So, Charlie, you mentioned that there were maybe some things that you didn't get in National Guard that active duty got. What would that be in particular? Is it like funding? Is it taskings? Because some of the National Guard units that I worked with, I believe it was 19th Group out of like San Antonio, Texas.
Yeah.
Does that sound familiar? They had pretty good
No,
funding.
We have, look, we Is have that kind all of the a, funding.
By unit? Or?
We have all the funding and stuff. The state gets to dictate our funding as opposed to just coming directly from the mothership. So, I mean, there's certainly challenge. Look, I'm not going to say it's better than active duty, because there's challenges and there's pros and cons. And funding is definitely a big one. Where you're not going to see a lack of funding is equipment, training, and opportunities. Where you might see a lack of funding is, for instance, like, hey, we want to send 5 guys to this school, and the state might just not have the funding to send 5 guys, so you might send 3 instead. But it doesn't mean there aren't schools available. It's just certain schools cost a lot more money than others. Instead of just coming from the mothership and asking them for money, we have to ask the state as well.
And for our listeners out there, Charlie, in the pipeline to become a Green Beret, doesn't matter if you're National Guard or your active duty, you're going through the same pipeline.
Yes.
You're earning your
Green Beret. It's the same course, yeah.
Same course. So what you're looking at is a little bit of a different tasking once you actually are doing the job. And correct me if I'm wrong, Charlie, but by the time, let's say you enlist, let's say you're a civilian and you want to go 19th or 20th Special Forces Group. By the time you do the SFRE, boot camp, you go through all your infantry training, you do SFAS, you airborne, HALO, you get done with the Q course, you do your additional languages, you come back to your unit, then you have to, and I'm sure I missed a couple things, but you come back to your unit, then you got to get mission qualified, right? So you got to learn how to work with your team and actually get deployable with your team, and then they're going to want you to deploy. So chances are you may end up doing like 4+ years of active duty orders, even though you're at a National Guard unit. Would that be correct or safe to say?
Yeah, I mean, we still have to get validated like every other team. You know, it's not like the the PMT, the pre-mission training, it's not like those are any different on active duty than they are for us. We still have to do the same thing. It just means, I would say, honestly, the biggest challenge is if you do have a separate career, it means you're going to have to block out a lot of time from that career. Because if we have 6 months trip to South America, you know, you're going to have to block off 3 months before that for PMT and then however many schools, whatever you're trying to do, line up before that timeline starts. So it might be a year out of your life for a 6 month trip where you're going to have to tell work, like, sorry, I can't be here.
By the time you go through 4 years of being a trained and then obviously being a Green Beret, you may not necessarily be a different person, but I mean, you're going to be trained in all kinds of different things, maybe electronics, explosives, firearms. You're going to know your team. You're going to know parachuting, maybe even scuba diving. I mean, there's a lot of things that you could get interested in, and maybe you end up wanting to do something completely different. So having those options is a big thing. And then you're talking post 9/11 GI Bill, man, you can actually get paid to go to school and be a Green Beret. I mean, that is sweet.
Yeah, I like it because, you know, it gives me the opportunity to have another job, go to school, or sometimes just get back from a trip and I don't want to do anything for a couple months. I want to go on vacation. I want to go, you know, go to Mexico for a little bit. So, you know, see you later. It gives you the options, but one's certainly not better than the other. You know, active duty, the active duty groups are, you know, they're amazing. And the National Guard groups, they have a ton of pros as well.
So, Charlie, talk to us a little bit about what you're doing now with SOCOM Athlete. Actually, let's talk a little bit about that hell day, man. I had an absolute blast with you up there at Virginia.
Yeah, that was fun.
And talk to our listeners a little bit about your experiences at that hell day and just kind of what you recommend for them based on what you saw, strengths and weaknesses of the students.
I saw the same thing there that I see. My biggest – here's what I'll say to avoid. It's the same thing for these hell days that people aren't enlisting for. You know, they're like, oh, you know, I got a date for 6 months from now for basic, but I think I'm going to push it another 6 months. Why? Well, I don't know if I'll be ready. You'll be ready, okay? Like, depending on who you are, most people, like, you're going to be ready. And people are, you know, people that are questioning, oh, hell day, oh, I'm not sure if I'm ready for hell day. That's why you go, because hell day is not selection. And the structure of it is, you know, we're going to give you a day where we're going to teach you how to do stuff. Then the next day, we're going to test you on it, and we're going to be really hard on you. It's going to be a lot longer. And then the next day, we're going to teach you again, because we're going to look at what you did the day before that you couldn't do under stress. And now, you know, we're back to friendly Jason and Charlie again. So now we're going to – the whole thing is, yes, there's physical things you need to learn. Yes, there's things you need to improve on, like, you know, almost everybody. But it's all – for me, it's all about taking the mystique away, because I never had anyone when I was young say, you know you could do this, right? All I had was people saying, well, you could never do that. You would never do this. I'm going, oh, geez, really? So all I'm trying to do for this is give you that mentality, like stop. If we don't tell you how many leg lifts you have to do or how many squats you have to do, stop counting. Count out loud to make us happy, but stop going, well, we're at 48. You think he'll stop at 50? Like those little mental tricks where you're like, no, you're going to go until I tell you to stop, because everything painful ends eventually. Just hammering that mindset in. You know, there's people that are weak in certain events, so we're going to make you do them a lot. And I don't even really care to see that there's actual technical, like, and, you know, proficiency improvements there. I just want to see how you're handling it mentally. Right? Are you going, you know that Jason thinks you're the coolest dude ever. So you're going to cry and whine and be like, Jason, bro, because we're not your friends on hell day. We're trying to show you that, yes, with us, we care about you and we want you to succeed. But cadre, don't. You're just a number. So we're giving you a taste of that so you can get over the come on, buddy thing and just like, just keep going. Just keep going. Because you can, everybody can do this if you just do it.
I'll never forget, Charlie, when you and I, we checked the water temp and it was 59 degrees. And the first time that we made the students go link arms, go shoulder to shoulder, water's edge, and go get wet out in the water and just hang out there for a little surf torture, I remember you and I were like, okay, we're only going to let him sit out there for 4 minutes max just for operational risk management's sake. You get out there and the students end up having a good time and they start singing Sweet Caroline together. And then you end up taking your shirt off and go diving in the water for a swim just to show, hey, man, it's no problem, right? So I think that obviously if you're at Buds or something and they put you out there for 40 minutes of surf torture, you're not going to be singing the whole time, right? But again, like the moment that you can't have fun, the moment that you can't keep your mind focused on why you started and just go out there and get your mind right with the boys, like that's when you're beat. And I was really impressed, man, at like how that team reacted. But I feel like one of the reasons why they reacted that way is because you took the torch and you showed them, just go out and do it, man. It's not that bad. So I thought that was pretty cool, man. And another good thing about Hell Day is that it'll expose those weaknesses. So many people, they're like, you know what? I don't want to go to Hell Day because I see all these scores on the score sheets that you guys post up and there's all these studs there. Well, look at the bottom. There's four or five people that finished that Hell Day too that have bad scores. I guarantee you.
Yeah, ask me how many push-ups I did at selection. It was like 55 or something terrible. It was awful. And they were like,
I only did nine pull-ups before I came in. Yeah, I only did nine pull-ups before I came in, man. I sucked at pull-ups. So, I mean, but I still came in and I worked my butt off and I did it. At the end of the day, there are certain things that you have to be ready for. And it's well beyond the PFT, PST pass test. However, you're never going to be perfect. You can't fear judgment. You just got to go and do it. So, yeah, Charlie, I really I had a good time up there with you in that Hell Day. And tell us a little bit about the mentorship side of what you've seen with some of the students, just from being a mentor.
It's different for every single student. Like, you know, we've had students that physically just, they're not there, but their heart is the size, you know, of a Mack truck. And so I look at them and I'm like, good, you're the easy one. You just have to get in shape. That's the
easy part. So you'd rather have a student that's got a big heart and that's coachable than a stud who's natural and just isn't really into it.
Yeah. Look, when I went to selection, I could run like the wind, but I was in terrible shape because I was tall and skinny. I couldn't gain weight. So like, ask me to put 100 extra pounds on my back. I'm going to complain. I'm going to moan and bitch and my knees are going to hurt. Like, but I wasn't going backwards. I'd much rather have don't go backwards kid than I'm a rock star, but I don't really give a shit. You know, it's the same thing. Like, I'd rather have a kid with a super low SAT score that's a 4.0 student than a kid that gets a perfect 1600 and got all C's, because it means he doesn't care. So yeah, I'd much rather have that. But then the flip side of that coin is we've also had kids who have been told, right, who have been trained to think that I could never do that. Oh, that's like, you know, that they're going to zip line down and cut someone's throat. Like, they think we have this mystique. They think we shoot fireballs with our hands. They think everybody's Jason Bourne, but they're ready. They don't even need training. They just need to go do it. And then they're going to wake up one day and go, well, that was fucking easy, right? And those are the other kids that are great to have, because you're like, hey, dummy, you got this. You can do this. This is possible. This is like really, literally within your grasp. You yeah. could sleep through the Q course and crush it because you're ready. But mentally, you already quit. And it's like not even Hell Day yet. So like, those are the other ones that I love, because I love watching the light turn on when you're like, all right, I'm going to give you something really hard to do. And you watch and go, oh, I can't do that. And then they score first in the class. And you're like, oh. Or you and me will look at him and we'll be like, well, we've been doing this for a couple decades between us, and you just scored better than I ever did. And they're like, oh, really? It's like you watch that light switch turn on and he's like, oh, shit. All right, well, let's do this. Let's sign up.
So, Charlie, we talk about leadership and we talk about being a good teammate and character quite a bit with the students. And that's one of the biggest things about Hell Day, is working as a team and being a solid teammate, being a solid communicator. Can you think of something that you lacked before you went into the Army that you gained when you got into the Army as a communicator? Like, you were a popular guy in high school, man. You were a friend. But what was something maybe you lacked that you gained? Because you said you weren't necessarily happy with yourself. What did you see that developed that allowed you to be a solid, reliable teammate as a Green Beret?
So I was fortunate enough to have some really great leaders who, there was a guy named Jason, and he was my mortal enemy. He was my team leader, my first platoon. And he would do things like, we'd be on an SKT. We'd been on a small kill team, a little recon site. And he would come up to you, and instead of going like, "Hey, are you awake?" he'd go, "What's the max effective range of a Mark 19 on area target?" And, you know, you're like, and you give him something wrong. "Oh, 1,500 meters. And instead of going like, no, he'd go, "I'm going to take your soul when we get back." And then now you're sitting up like, so he would do these things where he kind of socially ostracize you. And when you did well, he'd go, "Good. That's what I asked you to do." You know, and he was the kind of leader where I hated him. And then we became best friends because I started getting promoted and I started getting good at stuff. And then he went to Ranger Battalion and I got, you know, and so we were down in Georgia together for a little bit. And all of a sudden I was like, "Oh my God, I'm doing what you used to do." Maybe not as, you know, sadistically, but, and I say that jokingly, but it was what I lacked was ambition and drive. And so you can't be a leader without that, because if I had never changed, how could I possibly gain? And that's a big problem in the military that everybody's seen, is people gain rank because of time, not because of your actions. And then, you know, who the hell are you to tell me what to do? You've never done anything, right? And so he showed me, "I'll walk first, but you better be right behind me." And so it feels good to sort of have that leadership. And now I can look back and I can take kids and I can develop them. And I, instead of being, you know, like, "You're useless because you can't do it," it's, "Hey, you're really bad at this. I was really bad at this. Here's how I got better. Here's how you get better." And sort of what he did was he showed me that just because you're bad at something doesn't mean you'll be bad forever. And then I watched him do it well. And so I emulated it, and he gave me guidance, although it was tough love guidance.
You had some great mentors, and you know, you said kids, you know, and I know you obviously are aware of how many active military and older guys that come to our hell days. You know, Skip is older than I am, you know? But I have a recommendation for our listeners out there. A lot of you guys, you know, you're not kids. We have a lot. I would say our average age range is in the mid-20s. Some of the most common mistakes we see is if you're a little bit older, you have a little bit more responsibilities in your life. Life is taking a little bit more of a mental toll on you. You have baggage. And not only that, a lot of guys have another outlet plan. They have another place to go because they've kind of established themselves in life. So be careful about going into special operations selection just trying to give it a go. Be careful going into special operations selection with some kind of backup plan. It's always great to have a contingency. Okay. But a contingency is if the environment does not allow you to press forward. So maybe you get injured or something like that, right? You know, you have some type of contingency, but you're not just going and seeing how it goes with the attitude of, "Well, I have this if it doesn't work out." There is no option except for to succeed. So that's my biggest recommendation for our prior service guys that are already active duty or maybe cross trainees or whatever it is. You guys have got to eliminate any type of cancer in your life that's going to keep you from accomplishing your goals. The more time you have to train, the more peace of mind you have, the more focus you have towards being a great candidate and a great teammate, physically and mentally and spiritually, the better off you're gonna be.
I told one of our students this yesterday, he was like, "Hey, you know," he's talking about the why, he was talking about what keeps you in selection. I told him sort of a similar story. It was like, we had a lot of guys that were there. They could have done it. They could have made it. They came from kind of Gucci units, like a LRS unit or a Pathfinder unit. They were happy to go back home because they already had baseball hats and beards, you know, and they didn't make it. And it was because it was like, "Oh, I'm too cool for school. You know, I got this great, but I don't have to be here." I don't have to be here means goodbye. But the contingency is another, like I would say, very well said. The difference between a backup plan and the contingency is huge.
Well, Charlie, we're running out of time here, man. It was awesome talking to you. And I know we've been friends for a little while now, but I've never really gotten to hear your story, man. So that was a lot of fun getting to know a little bit more about you, my brother. Any advice for our listeners last minute as we're closing here?
Stop waiting. Okay. Get ready. Stop waiting. And everything ends. Time moves at the same pace for everybody. So you can be the guy with excuses or you can be the guy with a long tab.
Amen to that, Charlie. Thanks for coming on with us tonight, man. We'll go ahead.
Thanks for having me.
All right, man. Can't wait to see you soon for the next Hell Day, brother. And come down here and visit me soon, man. We're going to go ahead and transition into live Q&A, my brother.
All right. Sounds good.
Okay. We are live for Q&A. Our first question is Mr. Caleb. What's going on, Caleb? How are you tonight?
All right. So I got a question about the 18 x-ray contract. I know from what I've heard, he didn't go 18 x-ray, but I guess the question that he could help me with would be along the lines of, how do people view the people that take the 18 x-ray route? Are they, do they get the same on respect as somebody that would go like infantry and then drop a packet? Or
I don't like the x-ray program for one reason, because you don't know how good you have it. Okay. And that, it then lies, then the burden is now on you to react to that accordingly. So, and I'll give you a perfect example. I was in Africa. I was a brand new E6. I just finished Columbia Lancero School. So I was a wizard in the jungle. And I'm sitting there and I'm having a conversation with my E8, my team sergeant who fought in Desert Storm, and my captain. And they're going, we need you to accomplish this. You know, it doesn't matter what it was, but I was like, and it was passionate, but it was professional, right? So here I am, and I'm going, I'm not going, excuse me, Master Sergeant, but I'm like, Mike, that's, we can't fucking do that. You're asking me to do something that's fucking impossible. And the captain's going, yeah, but that's what we're getting from the top. We need that to get. And I'm going, you guys don't get it. You're not listening, you know. So we can have this passionate conversation. They're going, okay, well, tell me what we can do, because we're relying on your expertise. Okay, great. Next, you know, so here we are reaching with common respect, because we understand that this dynamic within Special Forces is we're result oriented. We're not rank oriented. Then the next day I go to my junior and I'm like, hey, we haven't done an ammo accountability in like 2 weeks. So I need you to get in there and do it. And he's going, well, why? The dynamic is not you can say and do whatever you want. The dynamic is strict military, but based on respect. So the day that I'm like, you can't do that, Mike. And Mike goes, we're doing it. It's lock it up. You got it. And I think that's something that's missing in x-rays, because they live their whole world with a baseball hat on. That said, that's a small number of x-rays that do not represent the majority. The majority of x-rays are brilliant kids who come in and they don't want to fuck around with haircuts and boots. So I think it's on you to take advantage of the things that the x-ray program offers you. But you have to understand you're still in the Army. You know, you are still in the big green machine. And I think that just, for those of us who are prior service, we don't have to remember that. It's just, that's the way it is, you know. And for x-rays, it's something you got to keep in your mind until you get enough runway under your feet that you're just another one of the guys. Does that make sense?
No, yeah, I get what you're saying.
All right. Great question, Caleb. Next question. Let's go ahead and go with Larim.
How are we doing, guys?
Doing good. How are you, Ariel?
I'm feeling good. I got a question about language school. And I plan to go 18X. But I'm considering taking a year to go to Costa Rica with my dad's family to master Spanish, to get some time outside of country. But I'm wondering if I'd be just fine going to language school at the end of the Q course and learning Spanish there. I don't know. I mean, I'm just trying to figure out how big of an emphasis language is within.
I get what you're saying. SF. Yeah, I get what you're saying. So first question is, are you Hispanic? I know this is an indelicate question.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's a big roll of the dice if you want to go the Costa Rica route, and here's why. You're Hispanic, so you'll probably go to seventh group, but yep, because you're Hispanic and you already speak Spanish, they might not give a shit. If you were a white boy and you spoke fluent Spanish, you're going to seventh group, right? But because you're Hispanic, they can't just send everyone to the brown mafia down there. They got to distribute them through the group. So they might look at you and go, oh, you speak Spanish and you're Hispanic. They don't care that you learned it, right? So it's a risk. Here's what I'll say as far as language school. You can go there and you can spend 6 months and do nothing, because everybody can get a 1-1. I got a 1+1 in Portuguese last time. I don't speak Portuguese. I just wanted to get paid on a second language. Anybody can do that. So my attitude when I was there is, I have to be here. I'm going to learn a language.
the reality is you can't unless you're being immersed in it, which is why you want to go to Costa Rica. So I was done with the 6-month book at like month two. I was staying after class every day, listening to Daddy Yankee and watching, you know, Nicky Jam documentaries. And so, you know, it's like I wanted to know how to say, where is the library, right? I wanted to know how people speak, right? I wanted to know slang. I wanted to be able to talk to Puerto Rican kids who cut the R's and S's off every word and their slangs. So it's on you to learn the language. I got my first 3-3. I don't know if you guys know the metric. It's 0, 1, 2, or 3 with a plus after each one. It's impossible to get a 3 if you're not fluent, right? I just got my first 3-3 this year after 10 years of – I work every single day to include – I even made the sacrifice of marrying a Mexican woman for my second wife, right? That's funny. You guys can laugh, I promise. So I'm telling you, like, it's so much work to learn the language. But I am a white boy from New England who speaks perfect Spanish, perfect Puerto Rican Spanish, because I spent 10 years working on it every single day, not just when I'm deployed, not just when I'm gone. So you want to go to Costa Rica for a year? I mean, we don't even need to go to Costa Rica for a year. But you can do this through the language school, but you got to stay after class every day. I had like 6 notebooks and like 100,000 index cards, right? Every single day, writing it down, you know? And even afterwards, like I watched Narcos and I'm like, whoa, that doesn't mean what the subtitle said. Why the hell does it mean that? Write it down, study it, right? Every single place, pick up the slang, stop. I just went to Panama for 6 months. Stop speaking like a Colombian. Stop speaking like a Puerto Rican. How do they say it? What do they use? Right. And then eventually it all blends together and you sort of get the result that you want. But it is constant work. But I am proof that they will give you every resource you need.
I think you got what you were looking for there.
But go to Costa Rica like every second that you can go to Costa Rica. That's
good question, man. I'm glad Thank Charlie you. Was able to answer that for you. Hit the nail on the head. Okay. Next, we got Chris.
Hey, good evening, Warriors. I want to start off with Charlie. Thanks for being here. It's a great pleasure being online with you. Mine's kind of a two-part question. The first one, if I understood right, you did have a break in service. The first one is, how long was your break? And the second part is, how was it integrating back into the Army and going the operator route?
It's easy, man. Nobody cares. My break was like a year, and then I didn't want to drive the Zamboni anymore, so I tried to join again. Couldn't join active duty, so I went the National Guard route. By the time I got to the National Guard, and I went in like 25th, like I'm an infantry man. Yeah, got the CIB on the back of my car. Nobody cares. And nobody cares that I was out. You know, it's like I got to selection. I was really strong on some things. I was really weak on other things. Nobody cared where I'd been. You are going to go in with Rangers with 79 deployments in 6 months, and you're going to go in with X-rays and water boys and truck drivers that don't know which boot goes on which foot. So use your experience to your advantage and lead when it's possible to lead, but nobody cares. And I'm not saying that in like a negative way, like nobody cares about your service. I just mean you, if you think you're going to be at a disadvantage because of your break in service, you absolutely won't.
Do you want to ask another question on that?
No, it because I know
that hit it.
Yes, it did. I know some people here already know my story. I was a prior Marine, but I've been out for 12 years, so I know it's kind of a different thing. Your 1 year break, so it did really help.
I just went to Iraq a couple of years ago. My team sergeant, he finished a Q course in 1988. He got out in 1992. He joined up in 2004. And then he took it. And by the time he retired after our trip in 2017. And then the other Marine thing, like you crayon eaters, man, my last team, my team leader was a Marine. My senior Echo was a Marine. My junior Echo was a Marine. So you're going to be fine, man. And honestly, all jokes aside, I think you do better. You guys do better than most in the Q course because you guys do not get lost in the baseball hats. You don't. You guys are, like, to a fault, beards equal no discipline type kind of guys. And it serves you so well in the Q course because you guys just grind.
All right. Next question. Let's go with Richard.
All right. So I've got two questions. The first of which is, what's daily life like as a Green Beret? And then, what was the most difficult aspect about becoming a Green Beret?
So daily life's a tough one because we work on like annual training calendars. So everyone on our team is going to have a different job. So everybody's day is going to be different. And once you graduate and you fall into a rhythm and you're not a junior anymore, the hazing's over, your day could be 3 days in the woods, or it could be beer till lunch, then whiskey till dinner. Like, it really varies because it's all about how you get your job done. I'm a weapons sergeant, so, you know, if we got ranges coming up, I'm going to get our ranges secured. I'm going to get our ammo requests in. I'm going to, you know, get the gun maintenance done. I got accountability stuff to do. But if I'm good, I'm good. You know, everybody's heard of GBNT, Green Beret nap time. Okay, we put it into every day from about noon to one. All right. All jokes aside, man, it's whatever your day is going to be. Everybody's got a different job. Every time we deploy, the Echoes, our radio guys, they are the busiest, most miserable bastards in the world for about the first week, maybe the second week. Then they are whatever we need them to be. Load magazines, drink beer, until the last 2 weeks where they're the busiest, most miserable bastards. Our medics, Mascow, you're busy. Not Mascow, someone's got an upset stomach, so you give them an ibuprofen, you know? Every day is a Bravo day. So we, you know, John Rambo was a Bravo. So was Jason Bourne. So, but honestly, it's different for everybody. You just got to do your job.
Charlie, you know where John Rambo's from?
Is he from Nebraska?
Bowie, Arizona.
Arizona. That's right. Yep. I did. Yeah. I should have known that.
Good to see you, Richard. Good question, man.
Good stuff. I actually had a second question if I could.
Yeah. Please go ahead, Richard.
So the second question was, what was the most difficult aspect for you personally about becoming a Green Beret?
Ah, that's a good question. I did not have a lot of confidence going into the course. I got selected. I did not physically do very well in selection. And so I was really worried about that. And I was also really worried about SUT, which is our little – used to be a 2-month version of Ranger School, same POI, but it's much more about learning the tasks than it is learning about yourself. I thought I was not going to do well at it at all. And actually, the most difficult part came when I did really, really well in the beginning, and they told me that. So I totally took my foot off the gas and absolutely just fucked myself with complacency. And I don't do well with positive reinforcement. I don't. I can't chase something. I have to be running from it. And so I like hearing. So once when they were like, hey, you have slipped top of the class to bottom of the class, I finished the whole course number two because I needed to hear how badly I was doing. So what's difficult for me is staying motivated because you're a victim. For me, I'm a victim of my own success. If I'm doing really well, it means I'm not going to do well. So people are like, hey, good job. I don't want to hear it. I don't want to fucking hear it. Oh, you're good job. Oh, no, no. I need you to tell me that I'm not doing well. Right, I need to be running from something.
Right,
it's going to be different for every. It's going to be different for everybody. You're going to have to find what keeps your gerbil running on that wheel, and for me, it was failure.
Yeah, definitely. That's a motivator for me too. I recently got disqualified from the Marine Corps, so 18 X-ray here I come. That'll definitely
do it up, man. You will be happier for it.
Definitely, definitely.
Rich, I know we've talked about this before, but keep fighting. If one branch doesn't work, you try the next branch. If that branch doesn't work, you try National Guard, you try Reserve. Keep fighting, my man. Keep working with different doctors. Keep figuring out how you can get treated for whatever your issue is. Keep fighting.
Will do.
Next question. Let's go ahead and go with Gabe.
Hey, Charlie. I've got a question about influencing what group you go to. You briefly touched on how if you are a white boy who's fluent in Spanish, you'll probably go to 7th. I'm looking to go to 7th or 10th. Is there any way I can influence that? I'm not going to selection for a while, but studied Arabic.
Yeah.
Should I?
Yeah. So if you they'll give you a wish list. But at the end of the day, there's not much you can do.
Hey, Gabe, real quick, guys, there is a new opportunity, 7th group only, and obviously 19th and 20th Special Forces group, which is National Guard, but 7th group only, you can contact their recruiting personnel directly, and you can get guaranteed a slot to 7th group.
I did not know that. That's awesome.
100%. Awesome. Back to you, Charlie. Go ahead.
Listen, if you want to do that, you need to set yourself up for success. And I'm just hearing about this now, so it's very possible that I don't know the details. But if you want to do that, and I'm just assuming you're a white boy like me with a name like Gabe, you need to get on that Spanish. You need to get on it. And you need to give them something so they give it to you. Again, I'm not entirely sure what the process is. It sounds awesome because who doesn't want to go to 7th group? Southcom life is the best life. But yeah, good luck with that, man.
All right, is it just Spanish the main language you guys go with, or would like Portuguese or French help me stick out a little bit more?
You can go with Portuguese if you needed to. If you go French, you're going to go to 3rd group. Portuguese, Brazil just opened up to us, so there's some stuff. I don't really know what I'm allowed to say, but Portuguese could help, but you want Spanish. You want Spanish. Because even if you go with Portuguese, you're still going to Colombia. You're still going to Panama.
Okay, would some foreign travel help too?
No, they don't care. And I wish it did, but they just don't care.
All right,
thank you. The best you can do is when I went, and again, the course changes every day, but when I went, right before language started, they said, raise your hand. They had an expert from every language up there. They said, raise your hand if you already speak a language. We had a couple Korean students that were Korean-born. They were like, I speak fluent Korean. Boom, no language. All they did was test them right there, right? Spanish, again, just like I told Ariel, they don't really care. So if you stand up and your name is Miguel Hernandez and you're like, well, I speak Spanish, they're like, sit down, right? But if I stood up and I was like, I speak Spanish, and I rattled it off and tested with their teacher, they'd be like, all right, you're done. You're rolling the dice big time, so.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. Next question. Let's go with Dusty.
Hey, man. How you doing? So I have two questions. So I'm currently active duty at Fort Bliss, Texas. And I was wondering, how can someone who is active duty better train and prepare themselves for selection?
Rock and run. Get your cardio through the roof. I was not confident with land nav. I had done it, but really I had done it in Alaska and Iraq. So in Iraq, I knew exactly where I was because I lived there for a year and a half. In Alaska, it's pick that mountaintop because I'm in a tundra. So I was like, well, what the hell am I going to do in the woods? They will set you up for success. I mean, I learned how to land nav at selection and crushed it. Never missed a point. Lost my map the first day, so that didn't go well. But definitely like ruck and run, man, and toughen your feet up. Deadlifts and squats, don't hurt yourself. Low weight, but you want your hip flexors good because your hips are going to be the first thing to go, then your knees, then your ankles and your back. So there is no secret to selection other than it sucks. And if you are good at rucking and running, you will pass as long as you're not an asshole. Only way you won't pass if you don't hit your gates is – you're not carrying enough weight during team week, or you are just an intolerable bastard and you'll get pinked out. Because selection, more than any other phase, peers matter more than anything. You peer out in selection, you're gone.
Okay. And then my second question is, so currently I'm the primary armor for my company. Will that affect the job selection that they give me if I get selected?
So I would love to tell you yes. Because I have seen, there was a kid I knew who was a carpenter, joined the Army. They made him an 18 Delta. He said, this sucks. And after he failed SOCOM the second time, which is the trauma medicine piece, they were like, you're done. You failed twice. You're out. Because that's the rule. And somebody was like, well, what do you want to do? He's like, I'm a carpenter. I want to be an engineer. And he was like, oh, my God. Crushed the Charlie course. Got his beret. I also know another guy who was a whiskey one. He'd already been through SOCOM because he was part of USASOC. So he was just a regular 68 whiskey one. So he's like, I want to be a Delta. And even if they make me go through SOCOM again, I've already passed it. I'd love to do it again. And they were like, you're going to be a radio guy. And he couldn't, there was nothing he could do. He passed, you know, cursed by his own success. He passed the Echo course. Now he's an 18 Echo. I would love to say that reason wins, but it's still the Army, bro.
Yeah, I understand that.
Yeah. Right. The best thing you can do, I'm sorry, again, the best thing you can do is your wish list. At selection, they will give you a piece of paper. 7th group, 10th group, 3rd group. 18 Bravo, 18 Charlie, 18 Echo.
Okay.
All right, next question. We have Sebastian.
Yeah, hey, what's up, guys? My question was, since National Guard isn't necessarily assigned to, like, the specific regions, like active duty, I was wondering, what are the odds a National Guard group would get deployed to Latin America like you did?
So we are technically aligned by battalion. So 3rd Battalion, 20th Group, we're aligned to Southcom with 7th Group. Everybody is technically aligned, but I like to call us AOR sluts. We will take what we can get. We won't turn down a free meal. So I like Latin America for a lot more reasons than the work. So I went down and became a Colombian commando because now anytime somebody goes, I'm going. I also got a 3-3, so anytime someone goes, I'm going. But that being said, I also spent 6 months in Iraq for the ISIS stuff. I've done 6 months in Africa for the jungle stuff. I went to Botswana. And anytime I want, I can go back to Botswana or Moldova. And then if anything pops off, you know we'll be back in the Middle East. Like, but you are typically going to stay with what you're technically aligned to. We just have a little bit more freedom of movement as far as somebody says, hey, Africa's putting out. Hey, what's up, Africa?
Right. Okay, cool. And I did have a second question just real quick about the Lancero school. Like,
yeah.
Was that more to, like, increase your reputation with Latin American partner forces, or was that something like Ranger School – where you wanted to, like, improve your skills?
So half and half, okay? Basically what I did was I went down there and all they see down there is special forces. So we are not special to them because that's all they see. We're the baseline. They'd always ask, are you a Ranger? Are you a Ranger? No, I'm not a Ranger. Oh, okay. So Colombian Lancero School is the standard for jungle warfare. And something you'll learn about Southcom is everyone's got their own commando course, but Lancero is the commando course. So it's also very officer-centric down there. So you can be a sergeant major and cut grass with scissors. And that's kind of an issue that we have to deal with a lot. So I went so that I could – I mean, my first trip after that to Latin America was Paraguay. I go down there and some colonel pushes past my major and my captain, and he's like – hey, it's like, don't this stuff, comandito, right? He's like, where's he at? And so he's like, yo, and everyone's got the same tabs, just different kind. He's like, yo, Chile, 94. And I'm like, Colombia, 2014. It's like an instant credibility, instant rapport. And the best part is if you go back to, I mean, even Colombia, anywhere where like everyone's got a commando tab, but a lot of them don't. Like maybe you look at a regular unit and a couple guys have Ranger tabs, a couple don't. You roll up as a white boy NCO with a commando tab or a Lancero tab on, and it's like, not only have I built rapport with those who have it, but those who don't are now already looking up to me without me having to display my proficiency in anything. And then the backside of it was I had a choice to go to Ranger School or Lancero School, and I said, fuck this, I'm going to do it in Spanish because they're going to give me 2 weeks in Colombia beforehand.
Right. Nice.
Where I trained very hard. Every day from about 10 p.m. to 4 a.m. I train very hard every day.
Nice. Thank you very much.
You got it.
All right. Next question. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Hey, thanks for coming on today. I appreciate y'all here.
Good to see you, man. No problem.
Thanks, you too. So my first question, and you've actually kind of been touching little bits on a lot of the things I wanted to talk about here. I'm gunning for an 18 Delta slot. Like that's what I want to do. I actually did a year of medical school. Long story why I'm not still in medical school. I mean, I'm a paramedic, about to have a tactical paramedic, flight paramedic, and critical care paramedic. I mean, that's what I want to do. How does the process, I guess maybe speak from your own personal experience, how did you become a weapons sergeant? How does that whole process work? Is there anything I can do beforehand or during school that will sort of help me along that track? Is there a certain group maybe that needs 18 deltas more that I could research beforehand?
With your experience, it's going to be as simple as, let's say that for some reason they don't give you 18 delta, which they will if you ask for it, all right? Let's say they don't. You just go to the cadre as soon as you get to the Q course and go, bro, these are my qualifications and I want to be a delta. They'll give it to you. Everybody needs deltas and everybody fails the delta course. I think their attrition rate is like 60% in SOCM, and that's just the first 4 months. So first eight months. So you'll get it. You'll get it.
Okay. Awesome. My other question. So, and again, there's another thing you were kind of touching on, the pink, you know, you called it pink slipped out. Basically peering out. How does all that work? And sort of, we actually talked about this on one of the other chats we were talking about with the Ranger, Sergeant Major. I'm a quiet person by nature. I mean, I work hard. I try to be the absolute best, but I try to be a pretty quiet person. Is that going to be a problem when it comes to peer selection?
No. I'm very loud. I've never been able to be the gray man, no matter how much I try. I've never not gotten a pink slip. But I get a lot of blues too. I'll give you an example. So in selection, I got three blues and a pink, and the blues were like, Sergeant Stetson keeps the morale up. Sergeant Stetson is funny and likes to make jokes. And then the pink slip was like, Sergeant Stetson is a dick and made fun of me the whole time. It's like, well, and the cadre was like, well, I figured out what happened. You picked on him.
Charlie, right? you mean not everyone can like us?
Yeah, right. Being the gray man is fine if you're not trying to be the gray man. I've never really held much respect for people that throw down and burn the city down with us on a Friday night, and then they get to work and they're mute for 5 days a week because it's like you're hiding, you know? But if you are a gray man and that's who you are, there were so many we went through, and it's like, you'll have your chance to shine and you will be forced to be in leadership positions. And if you can't handle that, totally different from being gray.
And strong personalities are going to conflict with strong personalities, and you have to be elastic and be able to bounce back. Whether or not you like somebody or not does not necessarily mean that you can't work with them. And if you're thin skinned and every time somebody gets on your case or has a conflict with you, or maybe lets you down or says something to you that offends you, and you can't bounce back from that, and you're too sensitive, you're too soft, you'll never make it on the teams. You'll get peered out all day long. So maybe somebody doesn't like you and they blow up on you, but how do you respond to it?
You'll know before it comes time to you'll never get a pink that'll surprise you. It'll never happen. Like during team week, I knew I was getting a pink because this kid was getting pissed off. Right. And so I just eased off of him. Right. So that way I didn't get four more pinks by guys saying, hey, this guy's a real asshole and he's picking on the weak. Right. That's not what I was trying to do. So when I saw it coming, I mean, you're a smart guy. You'll see it coming. I wouldn't really worry about peers so much. What you need to worry about is it's team week. Did I volunteer to navigate the whole time so I didn't have to carry sandbags? Did I volunteer to navigate so I didn't have to push the contraption? Or did I... Was I three people away from starting the line again, but I jumped up and took somebody's weight because I saw their hands were slipping. Carry more than your weight, do more than your share. It doesn't matter how many pinks you get.
Jonathan, there seems to be a lot of quiet guys that think that they're not going to get good peer evaluations when they get the selection. Speak with your actions.
Absolutely. Maybe for my own personal edification, maybe anybody else here, can you explain sort of a little bit more what you meant by pink? And I'm guessing from context, the blues are good and the pinks are bad.
Yeah.
And is there like a percentage and every single person rates you? Or how does Like, how does the whole system work?
Everybody else. If I'm in a squad of 12, I have 11 rankings. Number one gets a blue. Number 11 gets a pink. So okay. A lot of times I would have like a really good squad and we were all super tight. And so everybody would agree to rank everybody differently. So everybody got a blue, everybody got a pink. There's ways to game it. But if you're like some academy graduate who knows that knows more than everyone else and this and that, and you got seven pinks in a squad of 12, you're done.
Okay.
Right. But everybody ranks everybody. You're going to be on the bottom of someone's list and you're going to be on the top of someone else's.
All right. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Good information. Thank you.
All right, team. Last question. Let's go with Diego. Is that Diego Chacon?
This is me.
How are you?
You hear me?
Got you loud and clear.
Okay, awesome. Sweet. So I had just a couple questions. I'll try to keep it short. Thank you, Charlie, for doing this for all of us. Going into it, I read your bio. I totally thought you were going to be active duty 7th group all day. I was super surprised to learn that you were actually a guardsman.
Nasty girl?
Yeah, a guardsman. Yeah, so I'm a Texas guardsman myself, trying to keep an open mind, considering different stuff. But when it comes to Army, National Guard, SF, do you have more control over your SF experience in the Guard? And this is thing, I think you already answered a couple of like deployments and stuff, but when it comes to MOS language or the type of team, I don't know if there's like different type of teams, but do you have
100%.
Okay.
Yeah. You get to pick. So your company is going to tell you if they need something like, hey, we are 10% on Deltas. Sorry, son, you're going to be a Delta. Sorry. You know, that sucks unless you're like the last guy who is like one of those weird guys that just loves cutting people open. But like, I went and they were like, we need echoes. And I was like, bravo. And they were like, well, we also need Charlie's. Bravo. Well, we do have a lot of bravos. Bravo. Why? Because I'm in the National Guard. Then I got selected and they were like, we got you down for Charlie. Bravo. Because I'm in the National Guard. I also like maxed out the D lab. So they wanted to give me like Chinese. And I was like, Spanish. Bravo. Spanish. That's what you get with the National Guard. Nice. And now your company may not be aligned with Southcom, so you might get Arabic, and that's, you're not going to have a choice in that. Right. But you do have a lot of choice in what you get, as long as you work it out with your company. The Q course can't tell you anything. And then the other side is, as far as trips, that's where you have a ton of options. I am on, in 8 years, I'm on my fifth team of six in my companies, because I just keep hopping trip to trip. Hey, 2-4 is going to Paraguay. Well, I guess I'm on the Halo team now, right? Oh, but 2-5 is going back to Panama. Well, I guess I'm a diver now. You know, you can go wherever you want. The only problem you're going to have is everybody wants to be on the Halo team because everybody wants to go to Halo school. I've been trying to get that school for 15 years, okay? It ain't happening.
They get into the pipeline now, Charlie. Lucky them.
Not any yeah. I love saying that when they show up with their Halo hat on Skydive Arizona and they show up and I go, well, you earned it.
And then the second question I had is, did you consider other SOF? Like I said, I was just kind of keeping my options open. I'm in the Air Force right now, Air Guard, Texas Air Guard. But what I love about SF is just the culture aspect, the language, you know, teaching, working with foreign people, advising other governments on how to get rid of insurgencies, all that kind of, that specific SF mission sounds really, really cool.
I did. I almost went to BUDS. I'm so glad that I didn't. I never really considered, I wanted to go RRD, but I don't have a Ranger tab, so that was going to be a long path. I think it was going to be SF for me, and what other things I did consider, I probably got closest to going to BUDS if it wasn't going to be this. But again, I'm really glad I didn't because I like where I am.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
All right. You guys say goodbye to Charlie. Obviously hit him up. Actually, before we say goodbye, Charlie, what's the best way for these guys to get a hold of you? Instagram?
Yeah, Instagram would probably be the best one. You're going to have to please be patient if I don't see your thing right away. Just because there's times where, like, I have a lot of requests and I just don't get to them in time. But Instagram is probably the best one. And then if you at me on the Telegram chats, that's also another one where I'll be able to see those. And also real quick, you brought up teaching as being a big part of like FID and UW. And if these acronyms are, it's a big part of the SF job. So what I'm going to do, if not tonight, but then tomorrow, is I'm going to put up a link. I used it for college applications. It's just a 60-second clip of like the middle of one of my classes in Panama. And I like to show it to people because people have the wrong idea about what we do and what our job is. And what I love absolutely more than anything about our job is the, we call it the booger eater portion, which is just, yo, give me my G's, give me my foreign nation, and just leave me alone. Let me train them, live with them, eat with them, drink with them, train them, do all that. So there's like a 60-second clip. I'll put the link to it in the group chats. And then the other thing is, if you want to know more about Lancero School, this Colombian news channel did a report on us, and I put the link to it on YouTube on my Instagram page. It's like in my bio. It's all in Spanish, but it'll walk you through it'll show you some highlights, and it'll walk you through the course, and you get to see my awful Spanish from 8 years ago.
Oh, man. All right, Charlie. Thanks for coming on, man. You guys say goodbye to Charlie, man. You were awesome, Charlie. You're the
man. Thank you guys for having me.
Thanks for coming out.
Thank you
so much, Charlie.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Jason.
Thank you so much for coming on with us tonight. If you enjoyed the podcast, please take some time to give us a 5-star review. Give us a follow on Instagram. Check out our new YouTube channel. This is your host, Jason Sweet. We are out.
Stop off.
Thank you.
Up.
Down.
Four.
Up.
Up.
Down.